I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Miles Davis's famous Kind of Blue recording of five original tunes in 1959 has that quality that's often attributed to great art. It has an air of inevitability from the first note to the last, from one great solo to another, by the master players at the top of their young form. Davis. The tenor saxophonist John Coltrane. Alto saxophonist Cannonball Adderley. The pianist and composer Bill Evans, the rhythm players too. Paul Chambers on bass, Jimmy Cobb on drums, have what feel like preordained, providential moments on the 45-minute recording that has sold something like 5 million copies over 40 years. The bestseller of all time in classic jazz. The more carefully you listen to tunes like this one, titled All Blues, the more you know it all had to happen exactly as it did. Although the other truth of the story is that it was all improvised and something of an accident. It was an almost routine booking in the Columbia Recording Studio in New York, a union-scale gig for all the players except Miles Davis. They seemed to know immediately from the first tune that they had done a great day's work, but apparently none of them knew for some time that they had created a landmark in jazz and American music, which was on its way to becoming world music. Connection listeners, did you grow up on this music? And could you say why it works? The Kind of Blue Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. The music journalist Ashley Kahn has done something that probably ought to be done with a lot of recording and a lot of art. 40 years later, he has done the equivalent of an anatomical drawing of Kind of Blue, measure by measure, and man by man. He's written an account of just how it happened, an account that takes us closer, perhaps, to what it means. Join the conversation about Kind of Blue at 1-800-423-8255. Welcome, Ashley Kahn, and thank you for this book.
Hey, Chris.
One hesitates to talk over this music, but that's what we've got. That's what we're going to do this hour. Why does it work?
Well, that's the whole motivation for the book right there. We have an album here that's 41 years old, and you mentioned that it has sold 5 million copies. The most astounding thing is that it's selling more today than it did when it first came out. It's selling about 5,000 copies a week, which means a quarter million a year, and that's more as far as catalog sales in many record stores than Frank Sinatra, more than the Beatles at this point. So in the year 2000, why is a 41-year-old jazz album still so popular, and why does it continue to speak and defy categories, because it's not just jazz fans that are out there buying it, as well as generations. It's not just people replacing old, worn-out vinyl copies. It's a lot of new listeners who've been turned on to this album. And this is without any help from the record company. No marketing, no promotion. It does it by itself.
You're just adding to the mystique, but you haven't answered the question. Why?
Well, there's, many reasons to be pointed to. You've mentioned the incredible all-star lineup that came together in that incredible day in 1959.
And I didn't even mention Wynton Kelly, which is important.
Right, the rhythm section as well, Jimmy Cobb on drums, and the incredible Paul Chambers on bass. Just a band that was exploding with talent, and I say that literally because this was their only recording, this sextet. Within a year, everyone had sort of gone their own way and had to because they were band leaders in the making. There's this incredible convergence of great talent. 1959 being a time when jazz was just itching to change. There was all sorts of new experiments going on. Ornette Coleman arrived. Charles Mingus was recording that same year. John Coltrane's incredible Giant Steps was recorded within a month and a half of Kind of Blue. So all of this was happening at the same time, and as well, you have Miles and his personal musical exploration. And behind Miles, of course, you have the what was the sort of Mount Everest of record companies, Columbia Records, helping the recording out with probably the best and most identifiable recording studio of the day, 30th Street Studio, which you referenced as well.
Mm. You also have Irving Townsend, who was a sort of wise old giant in the business, sort of producing, overseeing.
Exactly.
We're still sort of circling around the question of the music, though.
Well, I think that what
the pulse and the melodic invention.
Right. Well, the music itself was, as I was saying, is points to where Miles was at in his personal explorations. You've got the gentleman, the progenitor of cool music, of the cool sound in jazz from 1949, and this is sort of the other end of the pendulum swing. He has been distilling, refining his sound for 10 years, and this is the ultimate statement of that sound coming together in 1959, and him creating this incredibly subtle, nuanced, late-night feel on Kind of Blue. His music would never be the same afterwards. He would move in totally different directions. So, again, to try and explain why this album, more so than any other Miles album, more so than any other jazz album, continues to be so popular and so influential with other musicians, etc., etc., I think there's a big part of it that goes beyond verbal explanation as well. What I have done, as you've said, is an anatomical drawing of the album and of its influence. Because I think in many jazz biographies, the details that we get bogged down with is just the musicians. And I wanted to expand it to actually do a biography of the album itself and how it continues to have its own life beyond, you know, what... I mean, Miles did not pay attention to the album weeks after he finished.
They all had other gigs that week and
exactly.
Other assignments and other missions.
Exactly.
And it is also, you have the payroll here. It's kind of astonishing how little everybody but Miles, the sideman, made on this gig. It's a scandal. I mean, it's very current in the argument about Napster and record companies and who owns talent and who makes money on 5 million records.
Right, and how do you nail down composer credits and composer rights? And so all these questions are generated by this album.
There's so many ways we could go at it, even in this hour, but to me the convergence here is, well, it's many, many people, but especially Miles, Bill Evans, who argued with him for the rest of their lives over who planted these tunes and what the creative process actually was, as well as who owned them.
Well, at least
and
two
Coltrane, plus Cannonball and the rest of the rhythm section. But I wish you'd just sort of sketch who's involved here in, to my mind, the big three of Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and Bill Evans, where they were in their lives, in their life lives as well as their music lives in 1959.
Bill Evans and Miles are pretty much, as you're stating, the two...
co-creators, should we say? Or?
Well, co-conspirators, I would say, because
they met in Miles' apartment the morning of the recording
right,
session.
Right, and sketched out and were purposefully only sketching out rough ideas. They wanted most of the creative energy to happen in the studio. The real interesting thing about Bill and Miles is that they were coming at modal jazz, but from different directions.
They haven't defined modal jazz yet.
Yeah, modal jazz is the breaking away from the chord structures, the melodies and the standards that had defined jazz pretty much for about its full extent from the teens on till the late 50s. Basically, the idea of having this blank canvas based on scales as opposed to chord patterns, which define melodies. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the melodic responsibility, the idea of the solo, is right in the moment and in the hands of the improviser. It's sort of like the exact opposite of what you would hear in smooth jazz, where you have a very common and a very known R&B tune, like a Marvin Gaye tune or an Al Green tune or something like that, where the improviser locks themselves into that melody and basically sings along to it. Here, and a tune such as what we're hearing right now, All Blues, Miles's solo on this, for instance, Miles is creating that melody on the spot. He's got the full freedom to do that. And that's where they were moving in the late 50s.
And yet they did also have charts. They had chord progressions, Blue and Green, which we'll listen to a little bit later. It is a tune. It is a structure.
Well, modal jazz is a very loose term. I should say that right now. In fact, in the book, one of the great discoveries that I was so, you know, spirited to find was a photograph of the music for Flamenco Sketches. And if there's one tune on this album that is the most modal, Flamenco Sketches is that. And in this photograph, you can see Cannonball Adderley's music sheet written out by Bill Evans. And up in the corner, there's a little note to Cannonball that says, "Play in the sound of the scales," with sound underlined. Mm-hmm. So he's not saying play the scales, stick to the scales. He's saying play yourself, be yourself, but use this as the starting point. And so modal jazz is a very loose term. But what they were trying to do was get lock into the moment, lock into the improvisation of the spontaneity of it all.
You talked a little bit about who Miles Davis was. I mean, he was the doctor's son from East St. Louis and had played with big bands. But you say it was a kind of 10-year development from 49 to 59 that brought us to this point. Who was Bill Evans?
Bill Evans was sort of the opposite. He was very much of a, where Miles had, well, he did have the upper middle class background, but he was very much schooled in the streets, schooled in the jazz clubs, coming up under Bird, etc. Bill Evans was totally bookish, very reserved, extremely modest, and had gone through music school down in Louisiana, gone on to studies in Manhattan, and had pursued a piano approach in jazz that was very classically influenced, and knowing very much about the classical music. Miles sort of stumbled into classical music through his studies at Juilliard, and then when he left Juilliard, continuing with his involvement with Ranger Gil Evans. But it was very much, he did it less by the book and more just by his ear. And so they sort of met at the middle. There's a point in the book where in the late 50s, there are quotes from Miles's girlfriend and Bill Evans's girlfriend where they describe what they listened to and what they did at home. And it's almost exactly the same thing. They're checking out Rachmaninoff, French Impressionists, Tosca, and playing very little jazz themselves. They're much more involved in classical music at home.
Where was John Coltrane coming from in 1959?
Coltrane in 59 was at the point where, in fact, he writes the liner notes to Giant Steps, recorded right around the same time as Kind of Blue. He wanted to get away from the more academic approach that had defined his sheets of sound, as they called it, his very verbose. I mean, his style of playing was almost the exact opposite of Miles as far as how many notes he would try and get into, you know, each solo. And he was trying to get away from that to a much more feeling approach. The modal approach that Miles defined on Kind of Blue and on stage following the recording of the album was exactly the booster rocket that he needed to go off and explore his music to take it to the next phase, which would lead to his own personal masterpieces like Impressions, My Favorite Things, etc., etc.
Ashley Kahn is our guest. We're talking about the biggest selling classic jazz recording of all time, Kind of Blue. He's taken it all apart, frame by frame, practically note by note, in a wonderful book about the making of the Miles Davis masterpiece. The phone's 1-800-423-8255, or join us online at theconnection.org. I'd like to go back to the beginning of the recording, So What. Let's just bring it in, and I want especially to listen for that moment after a kind of out of tempo prelude, where there's a sort of, again, one of these inevitable moments of drums, piano, and Miles's solo. Let's just listen and comment as you will. We're talking about the creation, some of it intensely calculated, some of it entirely mysterious, of what Ashley Kahns calls this nuanced late-night feel and a sound of music that's been with us everywhere ever since.
So we got Bill Evans and Paul Chambers there working out the, as you said, out-of-tempo, dreamy introduction. It was what is definitely inevitable is that this was the second tune recorded during the session, the first session of two, that they would take this and move it to the front of the album. It really opens the entire proceedings. It's also this melodic line here that they're playing just before the theme comes in was written by Gil Evans, according to the research.
Gil, not to be confused with Bill.
Exactly, the arranger.
You want to cue Miles?
And this is definitely, when people talk about the tune kind of blue, every now and then a musician will refer, or, you know, a listener will refer, you know, that tune kind of blue. This is what they're talking about, actually.
The tune's in the bass.
And this is
the riff is in the horns.
Right. So what we're listening to is So What, which has that incredible So What line in the horns. And what follows, you know, Boston Rest and George Russell will back me up on this, because, in fact, he named a whole album after this tune, So What, is Miles' incredible solo. Probably one of the best-known solos in the history of the genre. One of my favorite moments, too, just happened there, was the cymbal crash. And Jimmy Cobb, who's the only surviving member of the sextet that created this masterpiece, interviewed him about four times for the book. He hits the cymbal crash like 2-3 notes into Miles' solo. And Herbie Hancock mentioned this, and a friend of mine likens it to that moment in Bullet, you know, the movie where Steve McQueen locks in his seatbelt, and then this incredible chase scene, you know, takes place. It basically kicks the whole album into high gear. And that one little, you know, moment can speak volumes. And Jimmy's little cymbal crash does that. Mm. Right here, Miles is following the modal structure, which is basically two different scales. One, you know, during the one on the bridge and the other not on the bridge. And that's pretty much Bill Evans and Miles followed the strictest modal path. Cannonball was the loosest, and John Coltrane was somewhere in between. As I mentioned, George Russell has an album that's called So What, and his recording of So What on that, he takes Miles' solo and he turns the solo into the melody of the whole piece, and he has his 17-piece orchestra.
Here comes Coltrane.
Right. That his approach to scales and his almost pyrotechnics up and down the scales, it was perfectly suited for a modal type of canvas. But as he was saying earlier that year, he was definitely trying to inject more feeling, more emotion into his playing.
I keep trying to figure what Bill Evans is up to here. He's in and out of the action, so to speak, but egging it on.
That's, yeah. I mean, this was the one point, I think, that gave him the exit door a little early out of the sextet. He's not your normal rhythm player, like Miles's group had been accustomed to beforehand, with people like Red Garland. And if you listen to Red Garland and Miles's band in the years previous, he is one steady pulse maker. Bill is very delicate. Sometimes he's there, sometimes he's not. And the horn players, who are used to this drive behind them, were not getting that from Bill. And so it was a very different approach. And there's this collection of quotes in my book where, you know, Cannonball at one point says it, Coltrane another point says it, that they kind of missed Red Garland. They were not used to this. And there was a session that was done just before Kind of Blue in November of 58, where even Bill recognized it, and he said, you know, after we did these soft ballads and I was sort of, you know, feeling my way through them, Miles counted off Love for Sale, and there's this real spirited version of Love for Sale, because the guys were dying to swing, you know. But, you know, this was a different environment that they were exploring here. And
here's Cannonball Adderley on the alto saxophone. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. Or join us online at theconnection.org. We're talking about the Miles Davis masterpiece, Kind of Blue, with Ashley Kahn, who's written the book about it, everything about it, the men, the money, the music, the history, and the incredible sales of Kind of Blue. 5 million copies to this point, 5,000 a week today. 1-800-423-8255. John is calling from Buffalo, New York.
Hi, guys. I just was thinking about why this music is so popular and has been for so long. And I think that whether we consciously realize it or not, we're looking for and drawn to moments of euphoria in our lives. And this music puts us there. It's got an ethereal nature to it that runs the gamut from the virtuosity of the players to the soulful, bluesy mud that's all over this music. It covers so much of what American music is, what any music is. I think this is Mozart's favorite jazz album in heaven.
It's perfectly stated. In fact, when I interviewed Shirley Horn for this book, in fact, the two musicians who actually did want to compare Kind of Blue to some other recording were actually forced to go back to classical music. And Shirley Horn says, I think of Tosca when I listen to Kind of Blue. And Elvin Jones compares it to Pablo Casals, you know, solo, unaccompanied cello pieces, you know. So I think dead on. There's also that balance of the blues and that uptown sophistication happening here, which is exactly what Miles was shooting for.
John, can you top that? You're great.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the Kind of Blue connection with Ashley Kahn. Joel is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome,
can
Joel.
You hear me?
Yes.
Hi, how are you doing? I just had one quick question. I mean, this is one of my all-time desert albums, Desert Island albums. I mean, number one with a bullet and then some. But I was just wondering, what existed in the state of jazz back then that doesn't exist now that would allow such a creative process to take place? Or have I got it all wrong? Are these sort of creative processes still taking place? And if so, what sort of music can you point me to that would indicate something with such spontaneity and grace?
That's a wonderful question.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that Kind of Blue definitely is of its time and place. Is there a Kind of Blue being made now? Time will tell. The great thing about jazz in general, I think, is that there's always the sound of surprise, as Whitney Balliot wrote many years ago. There was no way to know 5 weeks before this album was being recorded that it, one, would be recorded, or two, would have the effect that it would have. And, I mean, isn't every change in jazz and in most musical styles pretty much the same? There was no way to predict that Ornette Coleman's free revolution when he arrived in New York later that same year was going to happen, nor that Coltrane would take lessons from both, or take you know, what he had learned both from Miles and from what he was hearing from Ornette, and then create his own, you know, surge forward through the early 60s.
You say they didn't know 5 weeks before the date. Did they know 5 weeks after the date that they had done something historic?
They knew they had made a good album. But to them, it was, like you said before, another day at the office.
When did it become the event, the kind of blue moment?
I would say that critics, it was different for critics, musicians, and music fans. For music fans, within a year of the album coming out, it was Miles' best-selling album, hands down. Selling more than his older, you know, albums like Porky and Bess or Sketches of Spain, which had just come out. For critics, within 4 or 5 years, they were saying, wait a minute, this is a very important album. This has opened up a lot of doors. And people like Jackie McLean and Jimmy Heath and, of course, Coltrane.
Hold the thought and the music. We'll be back. We're talking about Miles Davis's classic Kind of Blue with the writer Ashley Kahn. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Miles Davis Kind of Blue Connection.
Wait. Okay. Hey, when you raise up off this tube, man, you get... Oh, yeah. You know, your floor squeaks, you know. You know what I mean? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Let's go.
Here we go. Take two.
This is the Flamenco Sketches from Miles Davis's 1959 classic Kind of Blue, coming after a little bit of the studio chatter and Miles Davis's inimitably gravelly voice.
Right.
We're talking about the making of a classic recording with Ashley Kahn, the writer who has anatomized this recording session. You got to hear what we never heard on record.
Part of what you heard there is, of course, the master session dialogue and all the false starts, etc., which I was afforded the chance, the rare opportunity to hear, and makes basically accounts for the centerpiece of the book. And Miles's personality, the way that he ran a session, the way that he interacted with his sidemen, just came to life for me when I was able to hear. Basically, they had sent the record company, Sony Music, a parent company of Columbia Records, had sent upstate for this, you know, dusty
tape. These underground archives, yeah.
Exactly, and they don't often do that.
Makes you want to get into all of them.
Absolutely.
And not just jazz.
And you know, to hear them when they're sort of in their unguarded moments.
And what were they saying, and how did he run a session?
Well, basically, you know, the reputation that Miles has is being a stern band leader, of being very hard-nosed and rough exterior, and he's incredibly comfortable. He's just unbelievably supportive of his sidemen, compared to its reputation, of course. But once you start hearing it, once, or, you know, as it is in the book, once it's transcribed and you start reading about it, you realize that he was so totally all about the music and comfortable in the environment of the studio. So when he was making music, I don't think he could have been in a better place in his life. Here he is at 32 years old. He's at the top of his craft. He's also one of the best known and most commercially successful jazz musicians with a killer group around him. You can't say those names enough. John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, Bill Evans, Wynton Kelly, and again,
Jimmy Cobb, Paul Chambers, let's say them all.
Yeah, and in one of the top studios of the day. Pretty much it was the golden era of hi-fi when they turned on the mics and and did their best to just record what was being acoustically presented. Mm-hmm. It wasn't electronic processing or anything like that. That would come later. And it pretty much is the ultimate creative statement mm-hmm. of that decade.
One of the myths that's been exploded by now in your book and elsewhere, it was the notion that these were all just one take, because the last copy of Kind of Blue that I bought has two flamenco sketches.
Yeah, no, you're right.
What does that tell you?
Well, basically, Miles was a perfectionist, and the myth of the first take depends on your definition of take. He would work out that head arrangement, like the beginning of So What, which we heard before, or the beginning of All Blues, and he'd do it six or seven times. But once he got into the solo sections of the tune, that was it. And when the tune ended, however the solos went, that's what he wanted, because he was so determined. And Bill Evans, in interviews that I found with Bill Evans that have not been published before that are now part of this book, says the same thing, that it is all about getting that first unconscious, non-contemplative, creative gesture. Whatever spontaneously is coming to the improviser's mind and is getting recorded, that's the solo they want. So once they get that neat little head arrangement done, you are hearing one and only one take of So What, All Blues, Blue and Green, but there was two approaches to flamenco sketches. So that's...
The mystery, it's so fascinating. It's like a... It's like a thriller in this recording, and a lot of music, sort of the tension between complete control and complete uncontrol. And as you say, Miles is so supportive of his players. At the same time, he was all over the idea. I mean, he knew when he wanted Bill Evans. He knew when he wanted Wynton Kelly at the piano.
He would direct spontaneously in the studio, even after they had decided, well, this would follow that, and that would follow that. He would in the middle of the recording session step up behind different musicians, tap them on the back, and say, "Here, try this," you know, and direct it spontaneously.
1-800-423-8255. The Kind of Blue connection with Ashley Kahn. Sam is on the line.
Hi. Great show. Great music in the background.
Thank you, Sam.
I think one thing you forgot to mention is it's a perfect album cover, too. But I wanted to ask, Miles came out of playing with two of the great giants of the prior decade, with Dizzy and Charlie Parker, and I think they were playing at a much different speed, but I think maybe some of the modalities were, like, in fast pace what he was slowing down. But I just wondered if you had any comments about what he got out of playing with them and maybe even reaching back to Louis.
I think that, there was a point towards the end of the 40s when Miles realized, and in fact, Dizzy Gillespie relates a conversation he had with Miles where Miles went up to Dizzy and he said, "How come I can't play in the high register like you?" And, of course, Dizzy is so known for being able to slalom through those chord changes and go up and down the registers like, you know, no one's business. He was definitely one of the most virtuosic.
And Miles was not.
And he was not. And Dizzy's response to him was, "Because you don't hear anywhere but in the middle range. That's where you're hearing the music." And that was a very telling comment from Dizzy that Miles took to heart. And he said, "Well, obviously, I've got to find my own sound." something that was pure, vibrato-less. So I think that what he took from his years with the Beboppers in the 40s was almost like he needed to move away from that. And the Birth of the Cool sessions that he did with Gil Evans was definitely a much more quieter approach. Of course, his ability, though, to handle chord changes, and also his need to know the harmonic structure, to have that knowledge, to have that sort of compass at hand so that he could get through chord changes, was also very much a concern of his.
Do you want to argue about the sort of the Miles questions in general? I mean, he's such a...
figure?
We were talking about Robert Kennedy. There's a sort of a good Miles and a bad Miles and an early Miles and a late Miles and a fusion Miles. And as you said, the frustrated bopper people talk about, you know, Fats Navarro sort of cutting him in these contests. He could not play at the speed and with the versatility that some of the the other masters. And yet he created a whole space for music that hadn't been there before, too.
Well, he was I think at the very base, at the very core of his being, you have this frustrated musical explorer. And when I say frustrated, I don't mean that he couldn't achieve what he was setting out to do. I mean that he would never rest on his laurels. He was always moving and always exploring. So this intrepid spirit that he had always propelled him forward. The frustrations that the cold hard shell that the world would see, or the back that he would turn on to the, you know, turn to his audiences, for instance, in the 50s, that he caught so much flack and criticism for, is of course part of the Miles mystique as well. And it's gotten to the point where you almost can't separate it. You know, it's like, you know, how can you talk about Miles without the women, without talking about the incredible Ferraris and all that as well? But again, at the core, we're talking about a musical explorer. And if you just look at the 10 years from 59 to 69 and where he went after that, you know, and giving birth to fusion, I mean, he basically gave birth to at least 5 or 6 different musical shifts in the whole American music paradigm.
In the background, Blue and Green, it's part of the dispute about the whole recording as to whether this was Miles' idea, Bill Evans' idea, or an idea that came to them together. I think it's sort of in the books now that this was a joint inspiration, this tune. Blue and Green?
Definitely. Blue and Green and Flamenco Sketches are the two tunes on the album that are sort of up for, you know, consideration as being co-composers or not. And in the books, you know, I definitely explored further. And the strongest argument for it is not anything that took place in the sessions, but in music that predates the session. And Flamenco Sketches is based on an ostinato bass pattern that... Bill recorded as a work called Peace Piece. And the chords that open Blue and Green also exist on a Chet Baker album that where Bill did the introduction to a tune called All Alone Together, and which starts out almost exactly the same chordal sequence.
1-800-423-8255, the kind of blue connection with Ashley Kahn. Patrick is on the line.
Hello, Chris.
Hello, Patrick. Welcome.
Wait. Great show. I'm wondering if we can broaden the discussion a little bit. I know we're talking specifically about the album, but talk about what's going on in the culture in general. You know, we're in 1959 on the cusp of the 60s. That's a dynamic and violent time in our culture. Also wonder if we can talk about, you know, if there's any sort of intersection with Eastern spirituality. You're talking about the spontaneity of the moment. I think of Zen when I think of that. I wonder if you could guess and comment on that.
Wonderful question, Patrick.
Yeah, great question. In fact, a friend of mine who helped me out with some of the research on the book remembers a class, a college class he took in Zen, where one of the first examples of Zen was the professor playing the kind of blue album. The whole interest in Eastern philosophy and was starting to come out in the mid to late 50s. It was definitely there. It was definitely part of the New York culture and the the intersection of the intellectual academics as well as the jazz performers and the sort of bohemian scene down in the village. That was definitely there. And then you just have to, earlier one of the listeners mentioned the cover. Well, you just have to turn the cover over and look at Bill Evans' liner notes, and he's comparing a Japanese visual art to the creation of improvisational jazz, collective improvisational jazz. And of course, the Zen spirit is infused in all those artistic and creative efforts, most definitely.
1-800-423-8255. Ian is on the line.
Hey, I'd actually like to get very, very specific and find out if your guest knows anything about the reverb that is all over this record, and I think has a lot to do with the way that it sounds and maybe even for its popularity, and find out if that's just room sound and if it's not, whose idea it was to put it on the recording. You can hear a lot of it in the studio chatter. Sounds like he's in a gymnasium.
Yeah, that's a very good question. In fact, in writing the book, I kept thinking, how do I get the story of 30th Street Studio into this? And 30th Street Studio is this huge, cavernous, former Greek church that used to be on 30th Street between 3rd and 2nd Avenues in Lower Manhattan. There's a point at the beginning of Blue and Green, just when Miles starts his solo, where you can palpably feel the incredible cavernous interior, the vaulted ceiling, the wooden interior of this studio. However, in talking to one of the engineers who worked there, a gentleman named Frank Lako, who's thankfully still with us, he mentioned that there is indeed a little bit of added echo, sweetening, as engineers call it, where they ran the full mix down into a cellar room, and they had a speaker on one end and another microphone to pick up the results of this reverberating sound, and to run it back up into the mix. And it actually is on the master tapes are 3-track. They put it on the center track. And when you're listening to the 3-track, if you drop out the other two, you can hear that additional echo. The room had its own reverb, and they did add a little bit of sweetening, too. Good question.
Yeah, thank you, Ian. 1-800-423-8255, The Kind of Blue Connection. Bronze is on the line.
How you doing, Chris?
Excellent, Bronze. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for letting me be on your show. I just wanted to throw out that maybe the meaning behind this Kind of Blue album and why it sold so many albums over the years is not to be found in a technical analysis, but by using Kind of Blue as sort of a psychological Rorschach test for Black America and the civil rights movement at that time.
Explain.
For example, you can think of Kind of Blue at that time, and you can also understand the arguments about Bill Evans being on the album, and understand that Miles' lifestyle at that time, as being symbolized by Kind of Blue, was really the symbolic lifestyle of the overcoming and forward-moving Black psychology of the moment. That's why they didn't want Bill Evans on the album, because he was a Black thing, Black style, being transmitted to white America. And I still think that it's the same thing. You can't find that out through a technical analysis.
But expand on that. I mean, who didn't want Bill Evans on the gig?
Well, most of the members that were there didn't want Bill Evans on the gig. A great comment that Miles said is, if another cat can play better than Bill Evans, I'll put him on the gig. The truth of the matter was that Bill had some great conceptions in terms of background, but it was Miles' sound which was the course charter, if you will, through this new thing that we're calling modality. He could have made Tiddlywink sound good by playing over it. So I don't think that over-examining the background sketches or whatnot is really getting to why this thing is selling 5 million copies and 250,000 copies a year.
A lot of messages here. What is the psychological power of this statement, racially and otherwise, today, Bruns?
Well, it is grace through pressure. It is grace under pressure. It is the whole concept of being cool. When white people listen to it, they're looking into it because it has a classic exposition of American forms in European musical style. When black people listen to it, it is a music of overcoming. It is not unlike Jimi Hendrix's performance of the national anthem at Woodstock. It is not unlike Coltrane's Great Love Supreme. But for Miles, it was a much more intensely materialistic and socially overcoming issue. It was not too long after this period that Miles got hit over the head by a cop while he was standing out in front of the club.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that Miles was so held up as a civil rights leader was because he was the one whose lifestyle symbolized the overcoming. That's why he drove Ferraris. That's why he wore such great suits, as an expression of the overcoming nature and the class therein of the African-American spirit, especially during this pre-civil rights period.
This is fascinating. These are just a few more of the 10 trillion meanings of all this stuff. Actually,
absolutely.
What do you make of that?
I think what you have here is an album that means so much to so many people in so many different ways. And in no way can I, you know, agree or disagree with any person's interpretation of the album, because that's exactly true to that person. To many people, you're absolutely right. This album is a sort of badge of coolness. It's audio wallpaper. To others, they turn it up and they hear great art. And to others, it is an incredible social symbol of the times. And I think that there was a pianist I talked to, Dick Katz in New York, who mentioned that there had to be something to the idea of Miles creating his own. This is the first session where Miles comes in with original music.
Mm.
He's not doing any more standards. He's not doing ballads that have been around for like 30, 40 years. He's not doing, he's doing basic blues, but he's not doing well-known blues structures. And as such, that need for African-American music that would fit into the African-American music form of jazz, there was definitely that element to it too, that sort of breaking away from songs and music of the past.
1-800-423-8255, The Kind of Blue Connection. George is on the line.
Yeah, listen, really a great show. Julian Adderley was a good friend of mine, and I don't use that term loosely. And my question, I'd like to make a comment on the past caller. Those are his opinions, but I think what Miles did was bringing Bill Evans in. I mean, I know Cannon, you know, really admired Bill Evans, and Cannon was not a racist. And as a matter of fact, if you know anything about what you guys do, about how he developed out of this and the track that he took, he realized he was interested in reaching the largest audience he could, and in fact, from 1969 to 75, on his death, his band singularly broke the color line, as it were, and took a form of jazz to the general public that had never been taken before in that era. I mean, certainly.
George, first of all, I don't think nobody ever questioned that Bill Evans could play, and I don't think it's a question of. It's a question of the shades of meaning. What is the meaning to you of the white guy at the piano on this session?
It doesn't have any meaning to me. I mean, it's the band that was tremendous. You know, it's the band that was. I mean, spectacular.
Well, a good point would be to mention that only about 3 years later, after Kind of Blue was recorded, Cannonball decides to go into the studio for Riverside Records, and he records this incredible album called Know What I Mean, and he says, I want Bill Evans as the piano player on this.
Ashley Kahn, your assignment is to do this with about 100 of our favorite recordings. Thank you enormously for doing it with Kind of Blue. Thanks for help today from Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, Ben Walker, and Kim Bichari. And thank them all for Kind of Blue. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.